Hi.
Hello.
And welcome to another episode of Too Scared to Sleep.
Too Scared to Sleep.
That's right. Into the light, I command thee. Oh, man. Happy birthday, Dylan.
Thank you.
How was your birthday? Did you have a good time at Chuck E. Cheese?
Yes. I had a lot of fun. For anybody who maybe has not seen our Instagram or TikToks, Jake set up a birthday party for me at Chuck E. Cheese, and that was a delight. I will say it was very strange because a lot of different aspects of my life were coming together inside of a Chuck E. Cheese, which I have not been in since I was a child.
Yeah.
But we have you, we have a listener from the podcast, we had some old work friends from two different jobs, my current roommates, two different friends. It was just a whole bunch of people who'd never met before. It was a little bit jarring, but it was a lot of fun. And that Chuck E. Cheese pizza actually was pretty good. Pleasantly surprised.
Yeah, it was a pretty good. I had a really good time.
I did too, yes.
It was cool. One of the listeners named Mary. Mary and I have a lot in common because we grew up in the same kind of cult. She actually went to the same type of private Christian church school her entire life, just like I did.
So
we have a serious level of common denominator in our life when it comes to that. She was mentioning on the Easter episode how she was singing along with me when I was singing the resurrection hymn, because obviously she knows all those resurrection hymns just like I do.
Oh, God.
But I'm glad she came because she's my age, and she has children your age. Because she sat next to me and she goes, "How old are all the people around the room, around the table?" And I said, "No one except us is over 25." But yeah, you're right. I mean, I'm right. Am I not right?
I think Cass might be.
Okay, maybe.
But like, it's almost everybody there was at much least closer to
under
my age.
30.
Yeah.
I mean, even if I say under 30, because we're over 40. But it was fun to have her there because I was obviously playing party host, party dad.
Yes.
I was playing party dad, and she played party hostess with me and helped me do stuff because we've obviously thrown multiple birthday parties for our children.
That's true. You guys have a lot of experience under the belt.
We had some serious experience, so it was good to have her around. What else did we do? We sang those songs. We danced a little bit. You danced a little bit. I haven't had a chance to post that, but I'm going to. She bought you a chocolate unicorn, kind of like a chocolate bunny.
Birthday
cake flavored unicorn. Yeah. And on the back, there was this whole thing about the name. What is it? The month you were born, your first letter and your last letter will give you your unicorn name.
Yeah, something like that.
Do you remember what your unicorn name is?
I honestly could not tell you.
Okay. Well, I have this ongoing note always on my phone to give us ideas for the pop
what
topics
to talk about. Yeah.
Yes. And mine is Dashing Sugar Pumpkin. That's just impressive.
That's what your contact name is going to be in my phone now.
Oh God, I hope so. I need to lock down that domain name so I can do it. So I can take that.
All right, listeners, I'm calling on you to make sure that if you ever message us and you want to talk specifically to Jake, you have to call him Dashing Sugar Pumpkin.
That's right. Or just Dash.
No, Dashing Sugar Pumpkin. It has to be the whole thing. You don't get to escape this or make it cool.
Oh, God. I almost got into I really wanted to get into a fist fight today at my niece's soccer game.
Oh, nice.
She plays co-ed soccer. She's 12 years old. I've posted before on our TikTok when I've been at this soccer game, and there's all these kids, and there's like, it's just crazy. There's kids who have obviously gone through puberty and they're taller and, you know, they're more athletic than other kids. And then there's like scrawny kids who have not gone through. And then there's always like these behemoth looking half adult boys on these soccer teams that are just going crazy hard. And, this one boy kicked the soccer ball and hit her straight in the face.
Oh, no.
I know. And at that point, I'm ready to clear the bleachers when that kind of shit happens.
Oh, yeah. Listen.
I'm always ready.
I don't care if it's a kid. These hands are rated E for everyone.
That's
right.
I've
said it before. I'll say it
again.
I'm
ready to go.
I'll go punch a kid.
At a moment's notice, family vengeance runs deep in my veins. I'm ready to have a fight at any moment. So that happened. And then later on, the kid got a foul for body checking people on the soccer. There was like the referee told him, you know, you need to stop throwing elbows. I'm like, I'm about to start throwing some fucking elbows too. I'll go crazy about this.
As you should
have. So then, now, I would never hit a kid. Mm. It's not the kid's fault. The way that I see it is, I started looking around and I try to figure out exactly what adults this kid belonged to. And I zeroed in on his over 50 grandfather. And I was like, this is the guy. I'm going to go up to this guy and he had on an American flag hat.
Of course.
He had on an Old Navy t-shirt.
Oh, it's always the Old Navy
American flag tucked in and belted with a pair of cargo pants. And he was wearing fucking Grillmaster 4000s, white New Balance with the long socks. And I'm like, I have never wanted to punch a man in the face more than I do right now. He is an affront to all existence, and he deserves my vengeance.
Oh, that is so very, very good, Jake.
I know. And my brother, who is the father of this niece, because I have three brothers, but he's assistant coach, and I looked at him, and he looked at me. We have this kind of a telepathy thing going on. And I looked at him, and I pointed to the grandpa, and I'm like, I'm gonna go wild on this motherfucker. And my brother just gave me the nod. He's like, he gave me the shake. He's like, don't do it. I'm like, okay, fine, I won't do it. But I really wanted to get into a fight at the soccer game today.
Oh, would have thrown some hands, especially if a man leaves the house looking like that.
He deserves it.
He's asking for it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I really wanted to. Okay, Dylan, you are the most selfish piece of shit ever.
What the fuck did I do now?
I'll tell you why.
Oh, no.
On Friday, on your birthday, two things happened in the world.
Yeah?
Prince Philip.
Oh, yeah.
The husband of Queen Elizabeth.
Well.
The Duke of Edinburgh.
Yeah.
Died.
Not sad about that one.
On your birthday.
I mean, yeah. Okay. I did talk about that.
Yeah. Not only that,
my roommates.
But DMX died on your birthday as
That's
well.
That's the one that I'm sad about.
Who's gonna give it to us anymore? Because we were waiting for X. X was always gonna give it to us.
He was. God. And then he didn't.
Y'all gonna make me lose my mind
up in here.
God, DMX is gone.
That makes me so sad. I sent you the post on Instagram where it was like the clips of him talking about the tulips.
No, orchids.
Or the orchids, that's right. Yeah,
yeah.
Orchids. It's so sad. I do enjoy DMX very much. I was very sad to hear that he died.
I know, he's gone. I don't know. Also, Matt Gaetz, congressman from Florida. Oh, he is in so much trouble.
I've been hearing quite a bit about him. Did something new happen?
No, just him. People are quitting his campaign. His staff. He put out a note basically saying, you know, it was like the females in the staff office of Matt Gaetz want to tell you that we support him, but there were no names attached to this letter of support. So obviously someone, you know, it's bullshit. He actually, oh my God, he paid for underage sex using Venmo.
Yeah, fucking Venmo?
He might as well write an old fucking check and put sexual favors in the memo.
Honestly, there are very few ways that you can make it more obvious and be more stupid about it.
I mean, why doesn't he take a page from the British monarchy, and you know what's his name, the guy who didn't kill himself? Oh shit, I can't even remember.
Epstein.
I'm turning into my dad. I swear to Christ.
Yeah,
I'm turning.
We know,
okay,
buddy.
Last episode, I was trying to tell you about that guy who was the TV show. Okay, it was a show called The Nick. It was with Clive Owen.
Okay.
And it's set in 1900s New York City, and he plays a surgeon, and he's like the chief of surgery at this Knickerbocker hospital, and he gets addicted to cocaine at some point during the show. Like, he's all the way through, and at some point during the season finale, he has to go to rehab, and they put him on heroin to cure his cocaine habit.
Yeah.
And the reason, there's a lot of reasons. Obviously, the first reason that I couldn't remember any of that is because I'm turning into my dad and telling those open-ended, crazy ass where are the details stories, but the other part is because I never actually watched it. My ex watched it and she told me about that part, so at least I'm half, you know, that alleviates half of the blame. But anyway,
okay, yeah, you're not as far gone as we might have worried.
Oh, but at the same time, I'm headed that direction. We showed up at the soccer game and we were basically dressed the same again. It just keeps happening. I swear to God.
Yeah. Welcome to Too Scared to Sleep, an audio journey
of my midlife following
Jake's descent into becoming his father, who also talks about murder.
You say that, but you are totally 100% becoming your dad.
I'm a cooler version of my dad.
I'm glad he can hear you say that.
I have told him that to his face.
Oh my God.
I love my dad, but
right
I'm a,
now
I'm a
are.
Cool version.
Give it
of
about
my dad.
20 more years, and you'll be just like me, trying to remember stories about shows that you can't even remember, and you know, you're trying to drop names and you can't remember the name. You're telling these incomplete stories. Just
bold
like
of you to assume I'm going to make it to 42.
Oh my God. All right, enough about that. Jeez. Anything else going on? Oh, yeah. I made a bitchin' Amazon gift list, and thank you to listeners. And thank you to all the listeners who got gifts off of the gift list for Dylan. It was awesome.
Yes, thank you so much. It was so cool. It was so cool, all of you. It made it a lot of fun. I was not actually planning on doing anything for myself on my birthday. So then Jake set all of this up. So a huge thank you to you, Jake. You're I know welcome. I said it last night, but I do really appreciate it. And I appreciate all of you listeners for chipping in and sending me some presents and shit. Got lots of cool shit, man. I'm real hyped about it.
It was cool. I put a drinking horn. Hopefully you'll get the drinking horn at some point.
I know. If I don't get the drinking horn soon, I may buy it myself.
And then I put a kilt on there. And you just walked in the house and you were like, man, I'm going to buy that kilt for myself. And I looked at you and I said, you should probably hold off on that kilt. I'm just saying it. I'm just throwing it out there. A little birdie might be dropped. What did I say? The birthday goblin told me that you might be getting a kilt. So hold off on the kilt.
Oh, I really hope I am. I want a kilt so bad. I've wanted a kilt for a long time. I just haven't wanted to spend the money on it.
I know. But now you're a Scottish lord and you deserve a kilt.
I am a Scottish lord and I deserve a kilt. You're
Lord
fucking
Dylan
right.
Of Cadenhead.
Oh, you're right. That's and right. That reminds me.
The Laird.
So last episode, I think it was last episode in the bloopers, I had mentioned that I bought my card and certificate from the Satanic Temple.
Yes.
And those came in today. So that was a little birthday present for myself and... On the card and the certificate, because you put in your name, I put Lord Dylan Cadenhead. So I got to make use of that Scottish lordship title.
Mm-hmm.
But look at this shit, man.
I know, it's
this
awesome.
Is fresh as hell. And on the back, we got the Satanic Temple, too.
Oh, my God.
It's so cool. It's real cool, man.
That's really cool. Okay, and it's funny because I, you know, some of our listeners are probably... Anyway, I just want the listeners to know something about this. Okay, I looked up the Satanic Temple. Okay, the Satanic Temple's mission is to encourage benevolence and empathy, reject tyrannical authority, advocate practical common sense, oppose injustice, and undertake noble pursuits.
Yeah.
That sounds great.
Exactly.
There's nothing wrong with any of that.
No, not at all.
None of that is evil. None of that is nefarious.
Yeah, and because it is the Satanic Temple, a lot of people just immediately assume, oh, it's devil worshipping, human mm-hmm. sacrifices, whatever the fuck they want to believe that, you know, the fucking Illuminati are doing.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to read to y'all real quick. So the Satanic Temple has 7 fundamental tenets.
Are you going
to
read all of them?
I'm going to read all 7. You know why? Because I think more people should know about this, and more people should know about the Satanic Temple. For one thing, they're an amazing company, and they're really, really working hard towards true religious freedom, towards LGBTQ+ rights, towards female reproductive rights. I mean, they're out there doing a lot of really good work. And
stuff that the evangelical Christians should be doing.
Exactly, that they are not doing, but... The 7 fundamental tenets are, number 1, one should strive to act with compassion and empathy towards all creatures in accordance with reason. Number 2, the struggle for justice is an ongoing and necessary pursuit that should prevail over laws and institutions. Number 3, one's body is inviolable, subject to one's own will alone. 4, the freedom of others should be respected, including the freedom to offend. To willfully and unjustly encroach upon the freedoms of another is to forego one's own. 5, beliefs should conform to one's best scientific understanding of the world. One should take care never to distort scientific facts to fit one's beliefs. 6, people are fallible. If one makes a mistake, one should do one's best to rectify it and resolve any harm that might have been caused. And 7, every tenet is a guiding principle designed to inspire nobility in action and thought. The spirit of compassion, wisdom, and justice should always prevail over the written or spoken word. Tell me that doesn't sound like a good goddamn organization.
Sounds like a great organization.
Every single one of those is just saying, you are a human being, you have rights, you should be a good person, and you should just believe in what science tells you.
And use your reason.
And use your reason.
There are 5 holidays in the Satanic Temple, and I have decided that we are going to celebrate these holidays for the rest of the year.
Yes, one of them is in 15 days.
That's right.
From when we're recording this,
April 10th. I cannot wait for Sol Invictus, which is what they celebrate on December 25th.
I know.
I cannot wait to deck this place out for Sol Invictus.
Oh, you have no idea how hard I'm going to go.
Happy Sol Invictus.
Sol Invictus. It just sounds so much cooler than saying Merry Christmas.
Or, yeah. It's going to be awesome.
It's so good.
So cool. We're so crazy about this, but yeah.
I know. But yeah, they're an amazing company. You know, even if you are somebody who is Christian and you don't want to necessarily be associated with something that has, you know, satanic in the name, I understand that, but you can at least recognize that this is a organization of very good people who want to do very good things and defend human rights. Mm-hmm. That's all you need to know.
And if that still gets your goat, that's fine. I'm not sure you're aware of this, but the United States was founded on religious liberty, so we can believe whatever we want, and so can you.
Exactly.
So there we are.
Exactly.
That's our. Thank you for coming to our TED Talk.
Yeah, but anyway, that was the other thing that was pretty exciting. So I got some cool gifts from them. Then I got a cool gift to myself. And also tomorrow I'm going to go by the tattoo shop and set up my next appointment if I can, because that's going to be my other birthday present to myself, is another tattoo.
Oh my God.
I have had one planned out for so long, and I have been saving a lot of money so that I can work towards a new bike, and this is not going to infringe upon my new bike money.
Okay. Okay. That's fine. You do what you want. I'm gonna sit over here and judge you in father.
I know you are. Speak. I could watch. There was a physical change in your face as I said that. But you know what? I'm living life, man. You're just jealous because I'm cooler than you.
Yes, that's what I'm jealous about.
We're gonna go with that.
Can you tell? All right. You want to go first, or you want to go first?
Which would you prefer?
I keep going last, so I'll go first this time.
Let me hear it.
All right.
Hit me with it.
Here's my topic. Dylan, have you ever heard of thalidomide?
Thalidomide?
Thalidomide.
Yes, I have. I don't know very much at all about it.
Well, I'm about to educate you on thalidomide.
I'm here for it. Hit me with it, my friend.
Oh, man. It's so depressing. I can't wait. All right. So thalidomide was sold under the brand name. It is sold under the brand names Contergan and Thalomid, among others. It is a medication used to treat a number of cancers, including multiple myeloma, graft versus host disease, and a number of skin conditions, including complications of leprosy.
Okay. Right. Sounds like a pretty good thing.
Yeah, we're headed this way. Just wait. Thalidomide was first marketed in 1957 in West Germany, where it was available over-the-counter. When first released, thalidomide was promoted for anxiety, trouble sleeping, tension, and morning sickness. While it was initially thought to be safe in pregnancy, here's the kicker.
Oh, no.
Concerns regarding birth defects arose in 1961, and the medication was removed from the market in Europe that year. The total number of embryos affected by use during pregnancy is estimated at 10,000, of which about 40% died around the time of birth.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's got not dark a good fast. Thing.
Oh, boy. All righty.
Okay. Those who survived had limb, eye, urinary tract, and heart problems. Its initial entry into the U.S. market was prevented by Francis Kelsey of the FDA. The birth defects caused by thalidomide led to the development of greater drug regulation and monitoring in many countries. So there is our summary. And are you ready to dig into this bullshit?
I am looking at some of the images here, and I don't know that I am ready, but let's fucking go for it. Yeah,
Google Focomelia, and you're going to... Oh, God.
Oh, no.
But we're going to head that way. So back in 1952, thalidomide was synthesized by a chemical company, but was found to have no effect on animals and was discarded on that basis. But in 1957, it was acquired by a German company with a German-sounding name that doesn't really matter. And so they started to work to improve the lead compound, and they wanted to make it into a suitable drug. And the result was this thalidomide. The toxicity was examined in several animals, and the drug was introduced as a sedative in 1956, but it was never tested on pregnant women at that time.
Oh.
Okay, so researchers at this German company found that thalidomide was particularly effective anti-emetic obviously means it's going to keep you from throwing up.
Mm-hmm.
That had an inhibitory effect on morning sickness, like I said. So, in 57, the company launched thalidomide and began marketing it under the trade name Contergan, and it was proclaimed a wonder drug for insomnia, coughs, colds, and headaches. Okay. According to one of the documentaries that I've watched on thalidomide before, it was just like a miracle thing for people who had severe morning sickness.
Yeah.
So great. They're like, oh my God, this is so great. During that period, the use of medications during pregnancy was not strictly controlled and drugs were not thoroughly tested for potential harm to the fetus. So thousands of pregnant women took the drug to relieve their morning sickness.
Oh, we yes, hate to see
yes,
it.
Yes. At the time of the drug's development, scientists did not believe any drug taken by a pregnant woman could pass across the placental barrier and harm the developing fetus. I don't know what kind of hubris lends a person to think, oh, this isn't going to hurt. It's crazy. All right.
How do you not? Mm-hmm. Oh, God. I'm not surprised, but it's just ridiculous.
It's so ridiculous. They believed this, even though the effect of alcohol on fetal development had been documented by case studies on alcoholic mothers since 1957. So they had information on this. There soon appeared reports of abnormalities in children being born to mothers using thalidomide. In late 1959, it was noticed that peripheral neuritis developed in patients who took the drug over a period of time, and it was only after this point that thalidomide ceased to be provided over the counter. They're going to do everything that they can to make a buck before they cannot make a buck anymore. When the cost of all of these lawsuits and malpractice suits exceeds their profits, that's the only time that a pharmaceutical company will decide to do anything.
Yeah, that all tracks.
Mm-hmm. While initially considered safe, the drug was responsible for teratogenic deformities in children born after their mothers used it during pregnancies prior to the third trimester. Here's the best part about this whole thing. The word teratogen, which I just used as teratogenic, the word originates from the Greek word teratos, which is the Greek word for monster.
Oh.
So a teratogen is a monster maker.
Oh, that's sad.
Isn't it? Oh, my God. So in November of 1961, thalidomide again was taken off the market due to massive pressure from the press and the public. Experts estimate that thalidomide led to the death of approximately 2,000 children and serious birth defects of more than 10,000 children in Europe. About 5,000 of those were in West Germany. The regulatory authorities in East Germany did not approve thalidomide. One reason for the initially unobserved side effects of the drug and the subsequent approval in West Germany was at that time drugs did not have to be tested for teratogenic effects. They were tested on rodents only, as was usual at the time. Now, East Germany, West Germany. Mm-hmm. Guys, I don't know whether any of you understand what that is, but after World War II, the Russians and NATO divided up communist versus non-communist Europe, and the division line went straight through Berlin. And so West Germany was the communist side and East Germany was the capitalist side.
Okay.
And they actually built a big fucking wall down the middle of Berlin we call it the Berlin Wall.
Yes.
Right. They also call it the Iron Curtain.
I do remember that.
Okay. So that's why it's like West Germany didn't give a shit. East Germany was like, probably not.
Yeah, East Germany was like, hey, well, maybe let's not actually destroy these babies' lives. What about that?
So, in the UK, the British pharmaceutical company called the Distillers Company marketed thalidomide throughout the United Kingdom, Australia, and New Zealand under the brand name Distival as a remedy for morning sickness. Their advertisement claimed that Distival can be given with complete safety to pregnant women and nursing mothers without adverse effect on mother or child.
I'm sure they did.
Mm-hmm. Outstandingly safe Distival has been prescribed for nearly 3 years in this country, they said. Globally, more pharmaceutical companies started to produce and market the drug under license from that original German company. By the mid-1950s, 14 pharmaceutical companies were marketing thalidomide in 46 countries under at least 37 different trade names. In the U.S., representatives from the original German company approached Smith, Klein, and French, which is now called GlaxoSmithKline, with a request to market and distribute the drug in North America. A memorandum, which was rediscovered in 2010 in the archives of the FDA, shows that in 1956 or 1957, as part of its in-licensing approach, Smith, Klein, and French conducted animal tests and ran a clinical trial of the drug in the U.S. involving 875 people, including pregnant women. In 1956, researchers involved in clinical trials noted that even when used in very high doses, thalidomide could not induce sleep in mice. And when administered at doses 50 to 650 times larger than that claimed, by the German company to be sleep-inducing, that they couldn't induce the sleep. So okay. they couldn't repeat the effects. The researchers still could not achieve this hypnotic effect in animals that had been given to humans. So it's not working on the mice, it's not working on the rabbits, it's not working on the primates, but it's working on humans. After completion of the trial and based on reasons kept hidden for decades,
Smith, Klein, and French declined to
commercialize the drug. In 1958, that German company again reached an agreement with William S. Merrill Company in Cincinnati, Ohio, to market and distribute thalidomide throughout the U.S. So they just kept persisting until they found a pharmaceutical company that would say yes.
Yikes.
Yep. The United States FDA refused to approve thalidomide for marketing and distribution. However, the drug was distributed in large quantities for testing purposes after the American distributor and manufacturer Richardson Merrill had applied for its approval in September of 1960. The official in charge of the FDA review, whose name was Francis Kelsey, did not rely on information from the company, which did not include any of these test results.
Okay.
He's the first person to show any kind of sanity.
Yeah, fuck. Mm-hmm. How did it take this long for someone to be like, hey, maybe mm-hmm. not?
So Richardson Merrill, which was the name of that Cincinnati, Ohio company who wanted to distribute and market the product, they were called on to perform tests and report the results. The company demanded approval 6 times and was refused each time.
Yikes.
Mm-hmm. Nevertheless, a total of 17 children with thalidomide-induced malformations were born in the United States. Oldham Kelsey... That's Frances Kelsey, the FDA lady, was given a presidential award for distinguished service from the federal government for not allowing thalidomide to be approved for sale in the United States.
Hell eventually. Yeah.
Right? Silver lining to this. Not really, though.
Well.
Now, in Canada, the history of thalidomide dates all the way back to 61. There were many different forms of it sold, which were most common. The most common was called Talmalol. 2 months after Talmalol went out on sale, pharmaceutical companies sent physicians letters warning about the risk of birth defects. But it was not until March of 62 that both drugs were banned from the Canadian market by the FDD, which is their FDA. And soon afterward, physicians were warned to destroy their supplies.
Fuck, man.
Isn't this horrible?
Jesus. I mean, at least now they're finally being told, like, get rid of this shit, but still, that mm-hmm. feels like a long time.
Yeah. So now we're going to talk about the real meat and the potatoes of this whole story.
Oh, no. Because
we've been talking around it, but now we're going to be talking about the thalidomide babies.
Oh, no.
The use of thalidomide in women, some of which were pregnant or got pregnant after, in 46 countries resulted in what they call the biggest man-made medical disaster ever, resulting in more than 10,000 children born with a range of severe deformities such as phocomelia, okay. which I had to Google to find out how to pronunciate. I told you I'm suffering from dad sickness, okay? I don't know what to do about it. It's really accelerated. I mean... You can go back. Go back to our first episodes.
Honestly.
3 years ago and listen to me now. This disease that I have
has
progressed into like stage 2.
It is definitely hitting you a little hard today, Pop.
Go into my Instagram, my personal Instagram, and you can see when it starts hitting because I started wearing more plaid.
You changed your Instagram name to Dad Plaid. That should have warned us.
I went into stage 2.
It's fine. We'll deal with it.
Okay.
But we'll still love you.
Not only did it cause severe deformities like phocomelia, but it also resulted in thousands of miscarriages.
Ah, no.
Mm-hmm. The severity and location of the deformities depended on how many days into the pregnancy the mother was before beginning thalidomide treatment. For instance, if you took it on the 20th day of pregnancy, it caused central brain damage. Day 21 would damage the eyes. Day 22, the ears and the face. Day 24, the arms. And leg damage would occur if taken up to day 28. Thalidomide did not damage the fetus if taken after 42 days of gestation. So in the first part of gestation, you start off as one cell, and you divide into cells. And the first row of cells actually fold into themselves and turn into your spinal column.
Mm-hmm.
That's the first thing that's developed. Oh my God. Some of these babies were born without faces.
Oh my God.
Some of these babies were born with just like appendages that look like flippers.
Yeah, I saw horrible. Some of that.
Go ahead, guys. Go ahead and Google either phocomelia or thalidomide babies and look up Google images if you want to be depressed for the rest of the day. But I would counsel against it, okay? Because it put me in a funk, and I've known about this for years. I have known about thalidomide babies for years. I remember watching this when I was very young. It is not known exactly how many worldwide victims of thalidomide embryopathy there have been, although estimates range from 10,000 to 20,000. Doesn't matter. If it was even 10, it would still be horrible.
Yeah, no kidding.
It's a lot of kids. In the UK, the drug was licensed in 58 and withdrawn in 61, like I said. Of the approximately 2,000 babies born with defects, around half died within a few months, and 466 survived to at least 2010. In 1968, after a long campaign by the Sunday Times, a compensation settlement for the UK victims was reached with Distillers Company, which was the pharmaceutical company, which had distributed the drug. They paid out approximately £28 million in compensation following a legal battle. The British Thalidomide Children's Trust was set up in 73 as part of a £20 million legal distillment, like I told you, settlement, for the 429 children with thalidomide-related disabilities who were part of the class action suit.
Mm-hmm.
In 97, the company that became... Okay, Distillers became Diego... Diego at some point, and they made a long-term financial commitment to support the Thalidomide Trust and its beneficiaries. The UK government gave survivors a grant of $20 million to be distributed through the trust in 2009. In Spain, thalidomide was widely available throughout the 1970s and perhaps even into the 80s. What the fuck, Spain?
What the fuck, Spain?
There were two reasons for this. First, state controls and safeguarding were poor. Yeah, no shit.
Fucking obviously.
It wasn't until 2008 that the government even admitted the country had ever imported thalidomide. What the fuck, Spain?
What the fuck, Spain?
God.
Second, Jesus, guys.
I'm glad I'm not from Spain. Second, Grünenthal, which is the company from Germany who started this whole bullshit. The German company did not permit the Spanish arm of its own company to warn the doctors. The Spanish advocacy group for victims of thalidomide estimates that in 2015, there were still 250 to 300 living victims of thalidomide.
Oh, no.
Let's talk about Australia and New Zealand.
I guess let's do that.
Although the Australian obstetrician William McBride took credit for raising the alarm about thalidomide, it was a midwife called Sister Pat Sparrow who first suspected the drug was causing birth defects in the babies of patients under McBride's care at Crown Street Women's Hospital in Sydney. A German pediatrician named Widukind Lenz also suspected the link. He is credited with conducting the scientific research that proved thalidomide was causing birth defects back in 1961. McBride was later awarded a number of honors. The doctor, the obstetrician, mm-hmm. How about the midwife? God, fucking patriarchy. He was later awarded a number of honors, including a medal and prize money.
What the damn fuck? Prize money?
But he was eventually struck off of the Australian Medical Register in 1993 for scientific fraud related to work on something else. Hey, there you go. Karma's a bitch.
Nicely done.
Further animal tests were conducted by George Summers, a doctor who was a pharmacologist, which showed fetal abnormalities in rabbits. No shit. Similar results were also published showing these effects in rats and other species. But where is this in 1950-something? Oh, my God. Melbourne woman named Lynette Rowe was born without limbs. She led an Australian class action lawsuit against the drug's manufacturer, which fought to have the case heard in Germany. The Supreme Court of Victoria dismissed the pharmaceutical company's application in 2012, and the case was heard in Australia. On July 17th, 2012, Roe was awarded an out-of-court settlement believed to be in millions of dollars and paved the way for class action victims to receive further compensation. In February of 2014, the Supreme Court of Victoria endorsed the settlement of 89 million Australian dollars to 107 victims of the drug in Australia and New Zealand.
It's a lot of dollars.
It's not enough.
No, I mean, obviously not, but
it should have been twice that.
It's nice that they're getting something anyway.
Mm-hmm. So in East Germany, which is the capitalist side of Germany, thalidomide was rejected, remember, by the Central Committee of Experts for the Drug Traffic in that part, but was never approved. It was never approved for use. There are no known thalidomide babies born in East Germany. Meanwhile, in West Germany, it took some time before the increase in dysmelia at the end of the 1950s was connected with thalidomide, dysmelia's malformed limbs. Mm-hmm. In 58, Carl Beck, a former pediatric doctor, wrote an article in a local newspaper claiming a relationship between nuclear weapons testing and cases of dysmelia in children. Based on this, their FDA requested an official statement from the federal government. For statistical reasons, the main data series used to research dysmelia cases started by chance at the same time as the approval date for thalidomide.
Yeah, uh-huh.
After the Nazi regime, with its law for the prevention of hereditary diseased offspring, used mandatory statistical monitoring to commit various crimes, Western Germany had been very reluctant to monitor congenital disorders in a similarly strict way. Again, the Nazis were using it to exterminate people. They didn't just kill Jews. They killed gypsies. They killed little people. They killed people with Down syndrome. They killed people with all sorts of genetic abnormalities. Mm-hmm. They exterminated so many people. So they were kind of gun-shy about this. But the parliamentary report rejected any relation with radioactivity and the abnormal disease of dysmelia. But the FDA in Germany, which is called the DFG, I don't care why, research project installed after the Mende request was not helpful. The project was led by a pathologist who ran the project to propagate its teratological theory. Sorry. He saw a lack of healthy nutrition and behavior of the mothers as being more important than genetic reasons. Furthermore, it took a while to install a new Surgeon General in Germany, and it was not found out until 1962, some months after thalidomide was banned from the market. In West Germany, approximately 2,500 babies had been born with thalidomide abnormalities. In Canada, on this side of the pond, despite its severe side effects, thalidomide was sold in pharmacies until 1962.
Canada, come on.
Come on, Canada. You're supposed to
be on top of this. You're supposed to be better.
You're supposed to be the better version of us. The effects of thalidomide increased fears regarding the safety of pharmaceutical drugs. Ain't no shit. The Society of Toxicology of Canada was formed after the effects of thalidomide were made public, focusing on toxicology as a discipline separate from pharmacology. The need for testing and approval of the toxins in certain pharmaceutical drugs became more important after the thalidomide disaster.
Okay, at least they're getting their shit together a little bit.
This thalidomide scandal brought on changes in the way drugs are tested, what types of drugs are used during pregnancy, and increased the awareness of potential side effects of drugs. According to a Canadian news magazine, most but not all victims of the thalidomide birth defects receive annual benefits as compensation from the government of Canada. Excluded are those who cannot provide the documentation the government requires. Seriously? Come on. A group of 122 Canadian survivors formed a Thalidomide Victims Association of Canada, the goal of which is to prevent the approval of drugs that could be harmful to pregnant women and babies. The members from the Thalidomide Victims Association were involved in a program called STEPS over there, which is aimed to prevent teratogenicity.
Okay.
That's a big word, and I pronounced it the correct way the first time.
Look at you. Thank you very much. I won't even have to edit that one.
Don't edit that out, please. Back here in the United States, let's see how bad we are.
No.
Jesus. Okay, remember, the FDA first refused the approval to market thalidomide, saying that further studies were needed. This reduced the impact of thalidomide in United States patients. The refusal was largely due to pharmacologist Francis Kelsey, who withstood pressure from Richardson Merrill Pharmaceuticals. Mm-hmm. She subsequently was given a Distinguished Service Award by the President John Fitzgerald Kennedy.
JFK.
Although thalidomide was not approved for sale in the United States at the time, over 2.5 million tablets had been distributed to over 1,000 physicians during a clinical testing program. It is estimated that nearly 20,000 patients, several hundred of whom were pregnant women, were given the drug to help alleviate morning sickness or as a sedative, and at least 17 children were consequently born in the United States with thalidomide-associated deformities. While pregnant, children's television host Sherry Finkbein took an over-the-counter sedative her husband had purchased in Europe. When she learned that thalidomide was causing femoral deformities, she wanted to abort the pregnancy. But the laws of Arizona allowed abortion only if the mother's life was in danger. She traveled to Sweden to have an abortion, and thalidomide was found to have deformed her fetus. How sad.
That is fucking heartbreaking.
God damn it. True evil in this world.
Damn, son.
Kelsey, the head of the FDA who rejected it, she's just fucking badass bitch. I love her. All right, let's see. There was a cardiologist who testified in 1967 before Congress on the matter about the thalidomide effect on newborns after he made a trip to Germany where she worked with infants who had focomelia. As a result of her efforts, thalidomide was banned in the United States and Europe. The numerous reports of malformations in babies brought about an awareness of the side effects of the drug on pregnant women. The birth defects caused by the drug thalidomide can range from moderate malformation to more severe forms. Possible birth defects include focomelia, dysmelia, amelia, bone hypoplasticity, and other congenital defects affecting the ear, heart, and internal organs. Man, it's just horrible, horrible, horrible. In 1963, another doctor reviewed the history of the drug and the different forms of birth defects it had caused. And he quotes himself as saying, "The most common form of birth defects from thalidomide is shortened limbs, with the arms being more frequently affected. This syndrome is the presence of deformities of the long bones of the limbs, resulting in shortening and other in abnormalities." Back in Germany in 68, they had a criminal trial about this with the pharmaceutical company. They were charged with negligent homicide and injuries. And they settled with the victims in 1970, even though there was no finding of guilt, of course not. Jesus fucking Christ. A lady named... Okay, so that's basically it. It's horrible. Let's see here. Okay. At a ceremony... for the thalidomide babies, they unveiled a statue memorializing disabled children to symbolize those harmed by thalidomide and apologize for not trying to reach out to victims for over 50 years. At the time of the apology, there were 5,000 to 6,000 sufferers still alive.
Oh my God.
Victim advocates called the apology insulting and too little too late and criticized the company for not compensating the victims. They also criticized the original German pharmaceutical company for their claim that no one could have known the harm the drug caused, arguing that there were plenty of red flags at the time.
I would say there are plenty of red flags at the time.
Mm-hmm. There are some notable sufferers that I'm going to name off because these people are badass because of what they've done. There's a lady named Lorraine Mercer who is a... she's from the United Kingdom. She was born with focomelia of both her arms and the legs. She's the only thalidomide survivor to ever carry the Olympic torch. I feel like crying right now.
Oh my God. No, that's crazy.
I know. There's a man named Thomas Quastaff, who is an internationally acclaimed bass baritone, who describes himself as 1.34 meters tall, with short arms, 7 fingers, 4 on the right, 3 on the left. Large, relatively well-formed head, brown eyes, distinctive lips, and that his profession is a singer. But he has focomelia. Nico von Glasau produced a documentary called Nobody's Perfect, based on the lives of 12 people affected by the drug, which was released in 2008. And there's a lady named Mercedes Benegbi, who was born with focomelia of both arms, who drove the successful campaign for compensation from her government for Canadians who were affected by thalidomide.
Badass.
And then there's an Englishman named Matt Fraser, who was born with focomelia in both his arms. He is an English rock musician, an actor, a writer, and a performance artist. He produced a 2012 television documentary called Born Freak, which looked at this historical tradition and its relevance to modern disabled performers. This work has become the subject of academic analysis in the field of disability studies.
Okay.
So these guys have obviously taken a fucking horrible hand.
Yeah.
That this obviously. Shit. And tried to do good things, either, you know, good things for themselves, good things for other people who have been affected by it. But at the same time, you know, that's the idea of showing that people who have disabilities can still live lives, mm-hmm. you know, and be successful. It just really speaks to their spirit. But those are the thalidomide babies. Sad fucking story.
Yeah. Yeah, you were not kidding.
I told you.
When
I
you
it.
Said this was a depressing
episode. Try not to cry. I swear to Christ, Jesus. I tried not to cry.
I can hear it in your voice. Yikes, man. Yeah.
Anybody who has kids is going to know exactly how I feel right now. Because it's horrible. It's so horrible. It's
oh,
so
yeah. Horrible. No, I mean, this is... I mean, I don't have kids, but, like, still, that's a fucking horrible idea. Or, mm-hmm. like, a horrible thought, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Jesus. That's... Yikes, man.
I know. And if it hadn't been for Ooh. Francis Kelsey in the United States, we could have had even more.
Oh, yeah. No, definitely. Like, thank God for fucking... I mean, everybody who did this, you know? I mean, everybody to get credit, not just That's the true. Doctor. But yeah, no, holy shit. It could have been way worse. So it's excellent that it wasn't. But it was still really bad. Fuck, man.
Horrible.
Well, that was... A neat energy.
I know. Sorry about that. I know.
Cool, cool.
It's how it goes. That's how it goes in this story. I mean, you know, if you want, it would be funny if we did an episode where we talked about something super positive, but that's just not our jam. That's not what you came for, is it, guys?
No. Maybe we'll do that on the Patreon. We'll do one where we just talk about a positive story.
That would be so funny to do a topic that's like uplifting.
I know.
How would I even research that?
Oh, I don't know. Like,
what would we even talk? Oh my god, that throws me off. I feel like I'm trying to brush my teeth with my left hand right now.
I can't process like what it would be to do that. You can tell how good we are at, you know.
I mean, that really just threw positive. That really threw my head into a loop. Like, I tried to think of something positive to talk about on our podcast, and I came up with a fucking blank. My mind just went blank.
Literally nothing. No thoughts in here.
I got nothing. I got nothing positive.
Cannot think of a single thing.
Oh my god, that's not where our head goes. Anyway, that's my story. We're gonna take a short break, and we'll be back with Dylan's topic.
Yeehaw!
And we're back.
We are back. Hello. We have taken our break, and we have returned with our energy.
And now that you know who's not listening, we can talk a little bit more about Operation Ride at Dawn.
Operation Ride at Dawn. We are halfway through. We have gotten your part taken care of. We fucking did it, man.
We fucking did it. Okay, so listen. Here's what we're talking about. We're talking about my motorcycle. I broke my right leg below the knee in my motorcycle accident. And in that motorcycle accident, I fucked up the front forks, especially the right one.
Yes.
What's funny was, we'll post a photo of this eventually. The bike sustained the same kind of damage that I did. Its right fork was fucked up just as bad as my leg was fucked up.
Yes, it was.
Okay, so eventually I got to the point where I was like, okay, we will go ahead and take it to a dealership, the Suzuki dealership here in town, and see what they say about getting it fixed.
And we did that.
And it was horrible.
Yes, it was.
They come back and say, well, because of safety reasons, we're going to have to replace the entire frame of the motorcycle and all the components of the front end. Every single piece of this vehicle.
Which is fucking ridiculous.
So stupid.
Because the only thing that got damaged was the forks, the fender, and then the headlight got a little bit bent, but it still operated.
Yes.
That was it. Everything else ran perfectly fine. There were no chips, cracks, or bends in anything. Mm-mm.
They quoted me $12,000 to do this work. I paid half of that for this vehicle, for this motorcycle. And for $12,000, you could walk into the Suzuki dealership and say, I want that new, brand new Suzuki SV650. I'm going to pay $12,000 cash for it. And with tax, title, and license, it would not come to $12,000 to buy a brand new motorcycle.
Yeah, it's fucking ridiculous. They tried to tell you that it was totaled when, in reality,
they are out of their goddamn minds. I don't know who they think they're talking to. So I went and picked up my vehicle and said, no, thank you very much. I will go ahead and take it home. And so then I start looking it up and say, okay, Let's just, for starters, fix what we know is wrong with it. We're going to replace the front forks and we're going to replace the fender. We also had to buy a special, basically a jack stand for it, that lifts it up by its triple tree. If you know anything about motorcycles, but it's going to lift it up. It's going to take the pressure off of the wheel and the forks. And in the course of 3 hours, for less than $500, we replaced the front forks and the fender and reassembled my motorcycle.
Yeah. We
fucking did it. And then we pull it out and we're like, okay, let's try to ride around the block and see how it goes. And it runs exactly the same as it did before the wreck. We are gods.
We fucking did it, man. Like, it's impressive that we were able to do all that, because Jake and I both rode it around, and to be able to have ridden it beforehand and ride it now and without exaggeration say, wow, this is exactly like when you bought it, mm-hmm. That's pretty damn impressive.
Oh my God.
I don't toot my own horn that often, but that was fucking impressive, man.
I know. Someone was smiling down on me because we are about 7 months post-accident, and my leg is 100%, and I am back to full function, which is great.
Yes, absolutely.
I'm able to walk. I'm able to run. I am able to kneel down. I am able to go hiking, as I do all the time now, and do all the activities that I could before I had my accident. And my motorcycle is also fixed and runs just like it did before the accident, and it is awesome.
Just like it did.
Not only that, but I took the rider safety course, and I have so much more confidence and more knowledge.
Yes.
Now than what I did before. So we fixed it on, let's say it's Wednesday night, and then Thursday night I rode it around. That night I went around town. I actually left my neighborhood for the first time on my motorcycle and rode it around town, and it was great. And then Friday morning I rode it to the dealership where I used to work and showed my friends, and also it rode great. And it's perfect. But I posted a video that night of Wednesday night, and I showed it to my friends at work, and they were excited. And then I sent it to my brothers, and they were all, making fun of me and telling me, well, you need to go. My older brother was like, you need to sell it now that it's done. And I was like, whatever. The funniest part was that the next day, after he told me that he wanted to sell it, he sends me a post from Facebook Marketplace, and it's of a, what is it called? A Honda Rebel 500, which looks a lot like a Harley Sportster.
Yeah.
It's a 500cc bike. It's a cruiser. And he says, this thing's only, I don't forgot how much it was.
Those are super cheap. I think, yeah. I've seen at least probably one of the ones that he's looking
at. It was only like $800 or something like that. But he was like, I think I want to buy it. I was like, you should fucking do it.
Yeah.
Yes.
Honda Rebels are actually really kick-ass for starter bikes, uh-huh. because they're so low in the CC. But did you know they actually made a 1,000cc Honda Rebel?
Oh, my God.
Always really liked the look of the Honda Rebel, but I never wanted something that was fucking 500cc's,
because
that's nothing. But they made a 1,000cc version, and it actually looks sick as fuck.
Because
looks cool.
When I was researching bikes, I was like, Honda Rebels aren't that bad, and they're really competitively priced. But I watched a video where a guy got it up onto the interstate and he could barely hit like 65 miles an hour on it.
Yeah, that's the only issue with that. But then they were like, a lot of people want it, so let's just make a fucking 1,000cc version. And they did. It's really cool. If I didn't already have my sights set on a particular kind of bike, I would definitely consider getting a 1,000cc Honda Rebel.
Yep.
But it was just, I've got my own machinations. Yeah.
But remember, we have to tell these stories in the middle, because you know who listens to the first parts of our podcast just to spy on me.
And we don't like judgment from people that are mean.
I don't need no damn judgment. Anyway, enough about that. Dylan, what's your topic?
Me.
There was something else I was going to mention. I don't even remember what it was. If I remember, we'll throw it in here.
Okay. Alrighty. So I am actually talking about a topic that ties back to our good old friends, Ed and Lorraine Warren.
Oh, thank God.
I am bringing a paranormal one this time, because I have not brought paranormal in a fat minute.
You have not?
I haven't. I think my last one was the Not Deer.
It's pretty abnormal that you haven't talked about paranormal.
Is that what counts as comedy these days for you, Pop?
Apparently so.
Oh, God. See, it was fine when you were just telling neat stories, but this one hurt to watch. Your fall from grace.
Oh. It was going to happen eventually.
I know. I am talking about the bizarre case of Arne Cheyenne Johnson.
I know nothing about this, and I am so excited.
Really? Let's do this. So, this is actually going to introduce Mr. Arne about halfway through this story here, because we are focusing first on Debbie Glatzel from 1980. Debbie, along with her mother Judy, her father Carl, and her 11-year-old brother David, were renovating their new home in Brookfield, Connecticut. And all was going quite well. They had gotten about a month into the renovations when something odd started to happen to the family.
Of course. I love it, and I hate it at the same time, but I also love it.
That's the beauty of ghost stories! Mm-hmm. So, Judy had actually noticed David was acting strangely. Now, David, this 11-year-old, was usually a pretty sweet kid, very energetic and outgoing like most kids are.
Mm-hmm. Precocious.
Yes, but recently he was acting strange. He was timid and seemed scared of something all the time. At one point, she thought that she saw her brother get pushed onto the bed by some invisible force, like he was standing there and something pushed him back.
Oh, it's too late at night for you to be telling this story to me.
Yeah, I forgot to mention, we're also recording this way later than usual. It is 10 p.m. right now.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
And again, I have to sleep alone in this house with just Boomer, who doesn't give a shit.
He doesn't give a shit. He probably sees ghosts all the time and just doesn't care.
He's probably looking at one right now.
Little baby boy.
Oh, my God. I really want to rename him Totoro, but it's a little too late.
I mean, he's kind of established.
I know. He doesn't care what his name is.
But the listeners care, and they're a part of this family now.
That's true. All right, keep going. I'm sorry.
All right. Okay, so she sees him get pushed onto the bed by some invisible force. She kind of just plays it off as like he's just, you know, playing a little bit weird, or maybe she saw something. But little did she know, it was not that at all.
It's, when these things happen, it's too bad that there isn't someone around like us who would be like, no, I totally believe you, kid, when you tell me that there's a ugly man in the corner that only you can see. Because I would be like, yeah, I believe you 100%.
I know.
Let's
no
do
hesitation.
Something about this.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I absolutely would. I would absolutely believe that kid 100%. And be like, okay, let's fix this.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I know kids have active imaginations, but I have seen enough of the fucking Insidious and The Conjuring, even the fucking Strangers. Kids see some shit that we don't mm-hmm. see. They are on some next level shit. And this kid is definitely seeing some shit.
That's how I learned my prayer of perimeter protection, was because my godmother, who is a pastor's wife, has a daughter who's younger than me, who's basically my little sister. I mean, she's my sister without being my sister. We grew up together, and she saw an ugly man in her room, and her mom basically made up the prayer of perimeter protection and got this ugly man out of their house, and she taught me this prayer, and this thing works every single time for me.
Oh, so then you're totally fine if I just start playing some spooky shit in here, right?
No, I don't want to have to redo it. It's bad enough that I let you in here, a card-carrying Satanist.
Oh, like you're not going to go buy one.
I'm seriously thinking about it.
Don't think, just do.
Oh, my God. All right, keep going. I'm sorry.
All right, so this goes on for a little bit of time. David continues acting strangely. So Debbie, his sister, questions him a few times, and eventually, little David admits to seeing and being followed by what he described as a bizarre old man with burning skin who spoke to him sometimes.
Of course!
Do you know what he told little David?
Oh, God. Did he tell him to kill his family?
No, he did say he would steal his soul, though.
Oh, my God. God almighty.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, Jesus Christ, Shepherd of Judea, where are you now? Because we need you.
Not in this house.
We need you in this story.
Yeah, they need something, all right. So obviously everybody's a little bit uncomfortable with this.
Yeah.
They're keeping an eye on David, but ultimately they just wrote it off and thought that it was his imagination. Because they're not as in tune with the world as we are.
These people, irresponsible, just irresponsible.
If my kid ever told me that a man with burning skin told him he was going to steal his soul, I would just buy all the holy water I can, dump it on that child, and do some sort of weird little witchy shit.
You need to let me know, because I know people who can fix that problem.
Yeah, you will be the first phone call I make. I'm just going to line that kid in salt
yes.
and just leave him there
for a little bit. I know people who can fix that problem.
Because that is a horrifying thing to say. Mm-hmm. Let's see. So they thought that he was just being a little bit weird because they're imbeciles. And they just kind of let him do his thing until...
Oh, God. Here it comes.
That same year, 1980, we are now on July 3rd. The day before the 4th of July of American Independence. You know what little David is doing?
This buildup is giving me goosebumps. Go ahead, tell me.
I can't even look at you. He's waking up screaming in the middle of the night, saying that he's being hurt by a mysterious entity that he described as, quote, a man with big black eyes, a
thin
face, with animal features and jagged teeth.
Oh, God.
Who had pointed ears and hooves.
Oh,
David called this creature the Beast Man.
Ugh.
And he said that the Beast Man told him to beware.
Stop. Just stop. Just stop right now. Oh, man. Dylan, so reminiscent. Ugh. We have so many listeners who have experienced things like this in the past.
Yes.
So many people I know.
Beware.
Stop. Nothing ever happened to me that graphic when I was a kid, and I'm so glad that it did not. That is some serious shit.
Oh, yes, it is.
Oh,
yes, it is. The Beast Man. The
Beast Man is hurting me in my dreams.
Yeah. So at this point, they decide, okay, we're a little bit more worried about you now. You're screaming, waking up in the night, and talking about the Beast Man. So at this point, honestly, the mom is just worried that somebody is stalking them or trying to hurt her child. So she asks her fiance, Arne Cheyenne Johnson, to move in with them, thinking that he may be able to help out the family in case there was some sort of incident, or just have another adult figure around the house to help in case things got rough with her kid again. Because she is a single mom raising two kiddos, just trying to live life, you know?
One day at a time.
And what happens when you're a single parent with a fucking demon-infested child? Well, you gotta get some help. There's no shame in that.
Yeah.
Stop it. Get some help.
But is it the help that the kid needs?
Well, no.
Oh, God. Here we go.
No, it's not.
Let's hear it.
So, throughout the next couple nights, David woke up repeatedly over the night, covered with more scratches and bruises all over his body. There were frequently weird noises that were coming from the attic, but every time Arne went to investigate, he found nothing.
This is like the taking of Deborah Logan.
This is like the taking of Deborah Logan.
I'll never forgive you for making me watch that movie.
That movie's so good, man.
Ugh, the degloving Ooh. Scene.
Ooh, yeah, that one makes my skin crawl.
Oh, tell me about it.
Ooh, buddy. But let's see. So poor little David is now being attacked with more frequency, waking up covered in cuts, scratches, bruises, weird marks all over him. And this is happening repeatedly throughout the night. This isn't just like, you know, he wakes up once and it happens. It's over and over again.
I don't understand how people don't turn to religion in moments like this.
Well, eventually they will.
Okay.
But I guess it just hasn't progressed to that point yet. So David eventually started progressing more in terms of waking up frequently, feeling worse, being tormented more, and those night terrors he was having of the Beast Man, well, he started having those during the day, and apparently he started seeing the Beast Man throughout the day. He would appear to him as that animalistic figure, or sometimes as a creepy man wearing a flannel shirt and jeans.
What?
Who would be following him, but nobody else could see him.
Oh my God. First of all, I'm going to sleep with the lights on tonight. And secondly, flannel shirt and jeans? Really?
Yeah.
Is his name Randall Flagg?
Yeah. Fuck, I wish.
The walking dude.
That would be so much better.
Oh my god. This has gotten worse.
Oh, it has gotten much worse. So this kid's nightmares are now happening during the day, and he's seeing the Beast Man in different forms following him around and tormenting him.
I don't like any aspect of this at all.
I assumed you wouldn't. That's why I picked it. Mm. So at this point, the family finally decided to go to the church.
Praise the Lord.
So they go to the church and they ask the local priest to bless the house, hoping that that's going to be what gets rid of it. You're
supposed to do that on day one, but whatever.
You're supposed to do that super early on.
Oh, yeah.
But can you guess what blessing the house did?
It probably made things worse.
It did make things worse, Jake. You got it right. That's 500 points to Jake.
Thank you.
This only pissed off the Beast Man even more.
Oh, my God.
So poor little David's nightmares got worse. The noises that were heard in the attic and now around the house were getting louder and more frequent. Now here's where it starts getting even more uncomfy. Poor little 11-year-old David, being attacked all throughout the night, eventually began hissing, growling, speaking in voices that didn't belong to him, and quoting Paradise Lost, which is not something that an 11-year-old boy would have ever read. I could see the goosebumps on you.
Wow.
Just got to pepper in the Paradise Lost there for you.
Textbook. Textbook possession.
We are talking about a possession.
Oh. Awesome.
Yeah,
Paradise buddy. Lost.
Paradise Lost, man.
That's some dramatic flair.
Exactly. An 11-year-old boy speaking in demonic voices, quoting Paradise Lost, and also hissing and growling at his family. Is that not the coolest shit in the world?
Better to reign in hell than serve in heaven. John Milton, Paradise Lost. That you should get tattooed somewhere.
That's an excellent idea, actually, yeah.
I endorse that tattoo.
Nice! Finally found one he'll agree to.
Mm-hmm.
Excellent. Yeah, that's locked in. I'm definitely going to add that somewhere in here. okay, so now you have this progression happening. David's doing all this new level of spooky shit.
Mm-hmm.
And now his night terrors and attacks throughout the night have gotten so bad that they had to have some member of the family, either Arne or the mom Judy, staying with him, because David would wake up almost every 30 minutes with a new injury or feeling like he was being attacked.
Oh my god, this poor kid.
This poor kid.
I'm not into this at all.
Yeah, sometimes he would wake up during one of these 30-minute intervals, and he would be having a seizure because of how bad the attacks were in his nightmares.
Ugh.
Pobrecito.
Pobrecito.
So they reached out to the church a couple more times, and they didn't really feel like they could do anything for them. They tried blessing the house. They've said prayers. It didn't do really anything. So the family reach out to our good friends, Ed and Lorraine Warren.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what? Ed and Lorraine Warren, they showed up, man. They came in here. They were ready to go.
Like
the
fucking cavalry.
Like the fucking cavalry.
In case you don't know, and I don't know how you don't know this already, but Ed and Lorraine Warren. Ed Warren is a demonologist and Lorraine Warren is a psychic. And they are fucking rock stars.
When it comes
to paranormal investigation, they are like the granddaddy and grandmother. They're like they were the reigning king and queen of paranormal investigation for years and years and years.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, and they have the whole, oh man, the basement, the whole like tomb of haunted artifacts.
Yes.
God, we love the Warrens.
They went to the Amityville house to investigate that Amityville horror documentary that I referenced when I talked about Amityville that had to do with one of the Lutz kids. He went to see Ed and Lorraine Warren at one point. She had a piece of wood that she said, this is an actual artifact from the cross where Jesus was crucified. She had that in her museum.
What the fuck?
I know.
Oh my God.
And I'm like, This is one person that I would think is not joking about that. Like, it's got to be true.
I put a lot of faith in Ed and Lorraine Warren. I'll be honest with you. Lorraine
Warren, they are rock stars.
God, they're so cool.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but let's see here. So now they have shown up. They are doing their investigations. They are working with the church, and because it's Ed and Lorraine Warren, they're able to actually get some people from the church to come help them, actually get out to the family now. But after doing some investigation, they were able to see some of David's changes, bizarre actions, and stay with him so they could see the bruises and the marks on him. They, being who they are, know that this is very clearly signs of possession. At one point, they were talking with David, trying to get some more information out of him, and he started kind of choking up while he was talking to them, because he said that he was being choked by invisible hands while he was speaking about the Beast Man.
That happened to my dad one time.
Did it really?
I told you that.
Your dad got choked?
Yeah. He was at a revival, and he was at the pulpit, and he was preaching, and he started to cough, and the pastor who was there, because he's basically, my dad was the guest speaker, and the pastor for that church got up and said in Spanish, "I rebuke you in the name of the Lord Jesus. I rebuke you. Get away from him." Because the pastor could see a shadow person, a shadow demon behind my dad with his hands around my dad's neck. And my dad was actively choking at the time.
Oh, forgot about that.
Mm-hmm. Choking. Boy, coffee, howdy. Trying to catch his breath.
That's a yikes.
Mm-hmm.
Oof.
So I've seen it.
Yeah.
I was there.
This one, unfortunately, I don't think that they saw a shadow figure, but David still, could still
see. Same thing. I believe it. This is why I believe what throat. I believe. This is why I believe what I believe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It got so bad that Ed and Lorraine actually did definitely think that he was being choked. They stopped to see if he needed help, and then it, you know, eased up and he was able to breathe again.
Mm-hmm.
Now, some of the other bizarre things that started happening that Ed and Lorraine were witness to. Where David began showing increased strength that an 11-year-old boy should not be able to have.
Also a sign.
He was throwing things around and moving heavy objects. Now, there is actually about a 30-minute interview with Ed and Lorraine Warren that you can find on YouTube, and that was one of the things that I watched, is where I got some of this information.
Please send me that link.
Oh, I absolutely will. And I will be including audio clips throughout here.
That's going to be awesome.
But there is a part where Ed is, I believe it's Ed, talking about the strength of David,
mm-hmm.
but I'll go ahead and play that for you here.
David was in the very beginning stages of demonic possession.
Mm-hmm.
We went to the house this hot night. I can remember like the steam and the moisture coming off the ground. It was a weird night when we arrived there. First, Ed tripped going up the steps into the house, and Dr. Jim Grasso made kind of a laughing comment, and he tripped and fell too. And when we got in the house, we were sitting there at the table talking. Now, you would watch David, and he would be doodling, you know, drawing or something like that, and he'd be concentrating on what he was doing. And then he would look up, and it was no longer a little 11-year-old boy.
Now, this 11-year-old boy would become extremely strong. I seen nights when it would take 4 and 5 men to hold him down. He would be ranting and raving and yelling. There was times when he would attack his mother. Now, this boy loved his mother. He loved his father. And at one time, he actually broke the mother's nose, I believe.
That's fucking wild.
Yes, that is fucking crazy, right?
Thank you for that clip.
You are welcome. They also said that he was spewing obscenities, just some awful words at them,
mm-hmm.
Continuing to speak in voices that didn't belong to him, these bizarre voices and phrases that an 11-year-old shouldn't be able to understand or know or access. And then they began their exorcism process. Now, it is said that Ed and Lorraine Warren exorcised a total of 42 demons from this boy. Yes, they genuinely believed that one of them was Satan or the devil, whatever you want to say, some sort of something posing as that anyway. right?
Yeah.
But they began working. They got the help of the church. They put this boy through 42 exorcisms, all while his family is there and trying to help and doing what they can to assist.
That's a struggle.
Yeah. Arne Johnson was actually a very nice and caring man. It's not often in horror stories where we hear about it.
We don't usually get that around here.
I know. Like, this is the bright side here. But, I mean, he's just like the stepdad to this kid. But he's a very nice and caring man, and he's trying to support his stepson. He was trying to help with the demons, you know, getting the exorcisms and everything. And at one point during one of the more vicious exorcisms, when I was having a little bit more issue, David had apparently said,
"Take me on. Leave my little buddy alone."
And that's just heartbreaking. That's so sad.
Yeah, that is.
Yeah. But he shouted that at one point, and they were able to move past this. Excuse me. They were able to move past this particular exorcism. And once the whole process were done, Ed and Lorraine paid attention to that. And they immediately alerted the police. They were in contact with the police anyway, because they said, you know, from the get-go, they knew how bad it was happening. They saw how violently David had been lashing out and attacking people. They said there is a good chance that David is going to hurt himself or hurt somebody else. So they had already got the police informed on this to the best of their ability.
Okay.
But after this, they went ahead and told the police to keep an eye on Arne Johnson because they were worried he might end up doing something dangerous because he said, "Take me on, leave him alone."
He invited them in.
He invited something in. But he was feeling fine. He looked fine. But they said, just keep an eye on him. You know, they didn't want to straight up tell the police, "We think there's a demon in him."
Doesn't go over well with the police.
Yeah, exactly. But they were also trying to keep in contact and keep kind of an eye on him just to see, you know, make sure he was going to be okay too. They worried that with the demon in him, he would be lashing out. But this was all taken care of within the span of a couple months. I mean, the end of the exorcisms happened in November of 1980. So by November, things are pretty much back to normal, actually. The end of the exorcism was before this, but by November of 1980, which is the same year, everything had just returned back to normal. David had gotten back to his usual self. He was feeling a lot better. You could see his original personality coming back through now. Mm-hmm. And the family unit was getting along really well. It had brought them together. Everything was going good.
Until
they had moved into a new apartment under their new landlord, which was also Debbie's employer, a man by the name of Alan Bono. Fucking hate you two.
Don't be that way. They're a great band.
And around this time, Arne had started acting a little bit strange.
Here we go.
Possession 2, Electric Boogaloo.
Oh my God. I'm not okay with this.
So, he had started acting strange in a lot of the same ways that David had started acting strange. His personality was shifting a little bit. He was becoming more introspective, a little bit darker, lashing out a little bit more. But Debbie recognized this. She was fucking on it. And Arne had... She had been keeping an eye on him, and at this point, Arne had actually progressed to the point of the hissing and growling at the family while in these bizarre trance-like states, which we just saw. He eventually began getting into trouble with the police. It was never anything major, but just, like, aggression, getting into weird states and not knowing where he was, and he would have no memory of this when he would wake up out of these trances. All things we are familiar with and we have seen before and we knew was coming. But here is the kicker.
Let's hear it.
Arne began describing seeing a bizarre man in jeans and a flannel shirt and then started describing the features of the Beast Man.
Stop with the fucking... Oh my God, again. Again! The hair on my head just stood up. What little 5 o'clock shadow I have.
Yep. So now Arne is seeing the Beast Man in the daytime.
Now Ari can see Randall Flagg.
Now he can see Randall Flagg. Oh. We are nerds.
We are so nerdy. The man in black fled across the desert.
And the gunslinger followed. Fuck, that is the coolest goddamn opening sentence of any book.
Oh, it absolutely
is. In the entire
is.
Fucking world.
In the entire world.
God damn, Stephen King.
This is why I love him.
Fucking hitter after hitter with that man. Mm-hmm. All right, so we have now Arn acting weird, hissing, growling, speaking weird, getting into trances, seeing the Beast Man. And there is a point at which things pop off. That point is the next year, February 16th of 1981. Arn had called into work to spend the day at a dog kennel with Debbie, who was his fiance, his sister Wanda, and Debbie's 9-year-old cousin Mary. They were just hanging out at the kennel. Everything was going great. They were playing with the dogs, having a good little family time, just enjoying the day.
I don't like where this is headed.
Then Alan Bono shows up. And he was friends with them more than just like employer and landlord. Mm-hmm. He was actually pretty cool with them. He showed up and offered to take them all to lunch at a local bar. A little bit unusual to take a kid to a bar, but you know, whatever.
I mean, Chili's is a bar.
Yeah, that's true. But they go to lunch at this local bar, and it is reported that both Alan Bono and Arn Johnson have a few drinks, but nobody gets drunk.
Right.
You know, everybody's just kind of talking and getting along. It's going pretty well until they leave.
Until.
And then they head back to the kennel, and at this point, Debbie had began to sense some sort of bizarre, uneasy feeling. And it was growing pretty intensely, to the point where she was actively trying to get her cousin and Wanda, like, out of the situation. She wanted to just leave and get everybody separated. But when they returned to the kennel and Debbie was trying to get them out of the situation, an argument broke out between Arn and Alan. And of course it escalates.
Of course it does.
So the fighting is escalating. There are some threats being thrown around now. At one point, Mr. Alan Bono grabbed the 9-year-old Mary's arm and refused to let her go as Debbie was trying to get everyone away to keep them there and to keep fighting. And I guess to protect himself in case Arn tried to do anything.
Oh my God. So he's using the kid as a human shield.
Basically, super cool of Alan Bono. But at this point, Arn grabbed the knife that he had, and he stabbed Alan.
Whoa!
No hesitation. Gets the knife right into him. And not just like a stab and go. He stabbed him in the stomach and dragged the blade up closer to his heart.
Oh, Lord. This took a turn after a turn.
Oh, yeah. Now, Mary has, you know, left because obviously if you get stabbed in the gut and then have it fucking rip up you, then you're going to let go. So Mary is, you know, away now. She's with the other people. But does Arn stop at just the stab and the drag? No. He stabs him a couple more times. And then he flees the scene. Just hauls ass. Leaves Bono to bleed to death. Bono does definitely die.
What?
Bono is dead.
And Arn killed him?
Arn killed Bono in front of his fiance, his sister, and his fiance's 9-year-old niece.
Death by position.
Yes. He fucking... Do you remember that episode of Breaking Bad, Box Cutter?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he fucking box cuttered him.
Oh my God. Eastern Promises.
Yeah. Oh yeah, he just gets him real good. But they're in a public place, so people definitely saw what happened here.
Yeah, there's no getting out of this one.
No getting out of this one. But he does try to flee, and within an hour, Arn was arrested by police.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, they found him pretty easily at that point. And he was taken to trial for the murder. Now, while they were holding on to him, He actually said when he was arrested that he killed Bono because, quote, the devil made me do it. You may think that sounds a little bit familiar.
Mm-hmm.
Because Conjuring 3, which is coming out pretty soon, is called The Devil Made Me Do It. And it is based on this story, Jacob. This is the inspiration for The Conjuring 3, my friend.
Nice.
Yes. So he was arrested. He says that he killed him because, quote, the devil made me do it. Now, here's the thing about this one is we have had possession number one, hints of possession number two, a murder, and now a trial. The trial itself is actually pretty interesting. So this is the first murder in this town in almost 200 years.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, the town had actually, you know, they would have been celebrating their 193rd year without a homicide. And this is the first one that happens here. Now, the trial itself, like I said, is actually pretty interesting because the defense tried to argue and make a plea for not guilty by reason of demonic possession.
Mm-hmm.
They were actually bringing the possession as, you know, a major point in this trial. But they did try to make a defense for not guilty based on reason of demonic possession. They brought in some of the witnesses who had witnessed the initial possession, mm-hmm. including this one. And they actually did bring in Ed and Lorraine Warren as witnesses as well. So we have brought them back into the fold here. Now, during the trial, the Warrens fought in defense of Arne and actually ended up getting a lot of hate from the other people that were involved in the trial. People were mocking them and their profession, claimed that they were only trying to profit from tragedy, basically just trying to shit all over them and any credibility that they actually had, which, as we know, is a lot of credibility. And these people, they have managed to make a living off of what they do, but they're not getting rich off of this shit, you know? Yeah, they're just out there helping people.
Mm-hmm.
But eventually the judge did deny their plea, arguing that the defense would be impossible because there was no scientific way to prove that he had been possessed.
Right.
So instead they worked for a self-defense approach because the fight was initiated by Alan Bono, and then he did escalate things by grabbing a member of the family. So they just decided that was going to be their best approach for it. Now, this had gone on for a good little bit, and the trial had concluded, the jury eventually did find him guilty of first-degree manslaughter.
Right.
That was on November 24th of 1981. Now, he was, luckily the charge was brought down to manslaughter because of the self-defense,
mm-hmm.
And he was sentenced to 10 to 20 years in prison, of which he actually only served 5 because of his exceptional behavior. The other inmates, the guards, and the parole board all said that he was a model prisoner, and he was seeming to be a very good man. Most people didn't honestly even believe that he was there for a fucking murder. Whatever had happened after he had killed that man and, you know, followed whatever was in him, had told him to do that, you know, once he followed that, he was completely free of it. He, for the trial and everything, he went back to normal.
What the fuck?
Right? The beast man tells him to kill somebody, then he does it, and then there's just like, all right, cool, I'm a dip now, and heads out. But luckily, he only had to serve 5 years in prison for being an exceptional dude otherwise.
Yeah, because it all went away once the deed was done. My God.
Yeah, exactly. But it was the first case ever to cite demonic possession as a defense for murder. And that was why I wanted to include the trial part in there, because it's actually, you know, pretty interesting. And there was a whole lot of, you know, light on this case, not only for being the first one to bring up demonic possession, but also just because, you know, it was the first murder in almost 200 years in this small little Connecticut town. And then you bring in the big guns with Ed and Lorraine Warren. You get a 2-for-1 possession and a murder in here.
2-for-1 possession.
2-for-1 possession. Got that 2-for-1 special.
That's right.
But yeah, that's pretty much it. So this is both about David Glatzel and the trial of Arne Cheyenne Johnson. And that's pretty much it, my friend. But yeah, that is the inspiration for the new Conjuring movie, Conjuring 3, The Devil Made Me Do It. And I'm That's really crazy. Excited about that. I'm pretty fucking hyped. I hope it's good. But that was it, my friend. That was Arne Cheyenne Johnson's case.
That was a good one.
Yeah.
That was awesome.
Yeah. See, I had initially done, another like really upsetting true crime story. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I'm not just going to take, a quick little Rasputin break and then hop right back into the same tone of, this poor person was abducted and tortured for days on end. Like, let's mix it up a little bit in here.
Yeah.
And
I'm throwing in a amuse-bouche.
Ooh, so glad I found a good possession case. And then I kept hearing them talk about The Conjuring. I was like, hold on a minute here.
That's a good one. This was
it. Ah, yeah.
I can't wait for The Conjuring 3.
God, me too. It's going to be really good.
Plus, Patrick Wilson and Vera Farmiga play really good in Lorraine.
They do a really good job. I love both of them anyway. But they do a really good in Lorraine. I'm very excited to see them back. And it's been a long time since we've had an actual Conjuring movie. It's just been spinoff after spinoff, and I am so tired of these spinoffs, man.
So am I.
I'm going to be honest with you. They're not good.
No. They're I not watched good. The Legend of La Llorona not a while ago, and it wasn't that great. I haven't Although it did have Linda Cardellini in it, who I love.
I do like her.
I love, again, age appropriate.
Yes.
I love me some Linda Cardellini.
I think the last one that I had watched in that series was The Nun, and that was such a disappointment. But anyway, that was the horrifying cases of the thalidomide children.
Yeah.
And then David Glatzel and Arne Johnson. Mm-hmm. So here we go. Hope you guys enjoyed.
We're bringing the fucking heat. Isn't this episode 9? I think it is.
I think it is, yeah.
We only did 17 episodes last year, and we're already on episode 9.
And we have taken, 2 weeks off?
We had to. And it's only April, so we're bringing the fucking heat this year.
Hell yeah. Look at us go, man. I mean, okay, think about your list here. You know, just in terms of, what we've accomplished, we're definitely going to get the more episodes. We're being a lot more active, so we're trying to get some good listeners. We've got your bike fixed.
I know. Number one, boom. Number two, boom. Number four, yep. Number five, done. Number six and seven, we're doing it. Still working on that number three. But oh well, we'll get there.
We're all working on our own number three.
That's right.
But you know what? We are bringing the heat. We are bringing the thunder. This episode probably has a little bit of a weird energy because it's super late at night. It is now almost 11 o'clock.
Oh man, way past my bedtime.
It is way past Jake's bedtime.
Oh, but we love it. All right, guys, don't forget, we've got Patreon, we've got merch at Redbubble, we've got Instagram and TikTok. Follow us, like and subscribe, turn on post notifications, message us, send us stories. We need to do a listener episode because we've got some good fucking listeners.
Yes, we do.
We'll do that next.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But yeah, you guys can talk to us wherever you want. If you want to support us financially, please do. If you want to just support us by listening and telling a friend, a family member,
get somebody else tuned into the strangers,
bring them all in, send them our way. Mm-hmm. We will welcome them. We will make a place for them in our hearts and our home and our network. Anybody is welcome.
That's right. All right. Well, from Dylan, my co-host, my name is Jake, and we hope we've left you too scared to sleep.
So, the mom, Debbie, asks her fiancé, Beyoncé.
Everything that I said, forget it. Because you just fucked that one up so bad.
Yeah, but guess what? I've got the power of editing. So the fans will never know.
Oh, I'm going to put it on Instagram.
Just no! So
that better make the blooper reel.
Of course it is.
Okay, good.